Liston, one of the few women of her generation who achieved acceptance and success as a musician, arranger, and composer in the mostly male world of jazz. Liston was born in Kansas City in 1927 and moved to Los Angeles at the age of 11, where she started studying jazz with Alma Hightower, who led a youth band under the auspices of the Parks and Recreation Department. She joined the Musicians Union after high school graduation and began playing in pit bands and nightclubs. She played with Gerald Wilson's band, and he introduced her to Dizzy Gillespie, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, and others. Since this period in the 40s, she's arranged for many jazz bands and singers. She's recorded with and arranged for Dizzy Gillespie, Johnny Griffin, Randy Weston, and Betty Carter. She's also arranged for Billy Eckstein, Diana Ross, Aretha Franklin, Sarah Vaughan, Count Basie, Duke Ellington, and Freddie Hubbard. From 74 to 79, she lived in Jamaica, where she became the director of popular music studies at the Jamaica Institute of Music in Kingston. In 1979, the organizers of the Kansas City Women's Jazz Festival invited Melba Liston to attend. When she declined, they persisted. Since attending this festival, she's moved back to the States, and she's organized her own big band. It's called Melba Liston and Company. And this 17-piece band will perform this Sunday at St. Michael's Lutheran Church, 6671 Germantown Avenue, with sets at 6 and 9. The concert is sponsored by the Wilbur Ware Institute, and for more information, you can call 438-3710, and I'll have all that information again a little later. Melba Liston, welcome to Fresh Air. It's a really great pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
We'll be listening to some of the many recordings that you've played on and or arranged for, but before we listen to some music, let's talk about you a little bit. Trombone is it's unusual for a woman to be a jazz musician, particularly of your generation, and particularly to be playing trombone. How did you choose the trombone as your instrument?
Well, I chose it by sight, actually. I saw it. I thought it was the most beautiful thing, whatever it was, that I had ever seen. And I just had a feeling inside me that it and I should be together, would be together, and I had to have it. And in maybe 2 years or something, well, you know, I got my chance to put my hands on it, and I never let it go again.
What kind of encouragement or discouragement did you get for teaming up with that trombone?
Well, it was ridiculous. My mother and my grandfather were in my favor, but no one else. Yeah, the rest of my family said, oh, you got to be kidding. The music store owner, the music teacher at the school, everyone said, no, that's not for little girls. So if I have a clarinet, have an accordion, or have something. And as shy and quiet and nice as I was, at that time I put my foot down. I would not touch another instrument except a trombone. I just had love at first sight, and that's all I wanted.
Did you feel that there was something wrong with their preconception of the trombone being an instrument that wasn't
for
a girl?
No, I didn't think about it in that respect. They perhaps may have been right or something. I had great respect for, you know, elders and things. But I just knew that this was my instrument, that I had to have it. I know they mean well in things, but in this case, they were mistaken. I have to have that instrument. And so the person from the music store that brought the instruments out, he made a deal with my mom and said something about, well, let her try it. If she can get a sound off of it in a first try or two, we'll let her have it or something for $20 or something like that. My mom said, bet, you know. And I said, well, you know, I hugged it already. I said, you're mine, baby. And sure enough, I put it up to my mouth and made a big booming sound on it. And took it on home with me that night, yeah. So that was an unforgettable time. I don't know about predestination or any of those kind of things, but at that particular time, I felt that I must have that instrument. I didn't know why, didn't question why, but...
Did you know any other women jazz musicians?
No, I didn't know any musicians at all. Didn't know... Had ever seen a note of music or anything at that time. I just saw this in a store window, and I just got a feeling that I must have it, whatever it was. Didn't even know what it was, actually.
Well, let's listen to an example of your playing.
Oh, well.
And listen,
I'm not so sure that's a good follow-up to that conversation.
Why?
Because...
I've read you were shy. I guess this is true. Before we talk some more, maybe we can listen to a recording from 1956 of My Reverie, which you recorded with the Dizzy Gillespie Band.
Sure.
Do you remember this recording session at all?
Of course, yeah. We have been to Europe. We have been to the Middle East. I may come back. And we had a large repertoire. And so we got this session, and Dizzy said, we're going in, and we're going to do from number 22 to number 37 or something or other. One take only. If you make a mistake, it's your A, you know. And that's that. And I said, oh, my God. And my number was like number 29, somewhere inside there. And so there's no retakes going to happen. I said, my goodness, I have to be very careful. Well, we went on. We recorded maybe 20-something pieces, one take only. And mine came along through there somewhere. And I tried to be very careful so I wouldn't make a mistake and things. But the funny thing was about it, the only mistake was made by Dizzy. And he wanted to take his side over again. And the band said, no, you remember what you said? No, boss, that's... Yeah, one time only, I think. So I was happy that I was cautious and played. I'm sorry I wasn't more exciting on it, but it's a pretty tune, and I hope.
You arranged this too, didn't you?
Yeah, I made the arrangements, yeah.
Okay, well, let's listen to this 1956 recording featuring the Dizzy Gillespie Band and my guest Melba Liston on trombone. She also arranged this recording of My Reverie.
Thank you.
Mel Blisten featured on trombone on that 1956 Dizzy Gillespie Band recording of My Reverie, which was also arranged by Mel Blisten, who is my guest on Fresh Air, and her 17-piece big band will be performing this Sunday at the Lutheran Church, Michael's Lutheran Church at 66, St. Michael's Lutheran Church, at 6671 Germantown Avenue with sets at 6 and 9, a concert sponsored by the Wilbur Ware Institute. Well, when you studied, when you were young, you studied with a woman named Alma Hightower.
Oh, yes. Aunt Alma, we call her.
Really? Yeah. Do you think it helped having a woman teacher to be encouraged as a beginning trombonist?
Well, I suppose so. She was so devoted to youth and to music. And she had that sort of auntie or grandma instinct or something. She would, at this recreation center where we would play, she'd just come out there and just grab us by the scuff of our neck or something. She'd say, come on in here, child, and practice some music or something other like that. And she was just marvelous. She had had many sets of musicians through the years prior to us, I found out later. Maybe 3 or 4 generations of youth bands and things, all through the WPA and stuff like that. And she would make games of counting music and clapping and, you know, and exercises, riddles and things like that. It made it, like, fun.
So she didn't think it was weird for a girl to be playing trombone?
Oh, no. She was very encouraging to me. As a matter of fact, she told me, she says, you got something special. You hang in there, you'll be somebody important and when you grow up, you know, and things. But I didn't know what she was talking about, but...
Well, you joined the Musicians Union after you graduated high school.
Yeah.
Was there any resistance since you were a woman?
Oh, wow. You can't imagine how they talk to little girls when they join the union or when they join the band. I can't even see it on the radio, but... After a while, you see, back in those days, when you joined the union, you had to take an exam. You had to prove yourself a musician. You had to read some music. You had to hear and do things. They don't do that anymore. But, of course, I passed all of those with flying colors and stuff. And I think that annoyed them more than anything, you know, a little fast. Broad, you know, whatever they call girls and things. But then when I took the audition for the pit band at the Lincoln Theater, the band was consisted of, like, retired road people. You know, maybe they were in their 30s or something, other, you know, from ex-Benny Carter band, ex-Les Height band, and things like that. And so Bardu Ally, the band leader, they told him, he said, like, damn, you're bringing in all these little boys. Now you're bringing in little, with the female dogs, what they call them, and things like that, you know? And he said, well, if the female dogs can play the music and pass the test, well, they got the job, you know? And, of course, he pulled out the hardest music in the book to audition me with. And, of course, I played it with no mistakes. And he said, well, the dog got the job. But it was only for a moment. And, you know, they decided to be my friend and stuff like that. After they found out that I was really serious about the music, they decided that I was daughter or niece or little sister and things, and proceeded to welcome me into the family and told me if I wasn't too noisy or too aggressive and things like that, that one of these days I might make a decent musician, and they would help me all they could.
But you had to behave. Kind of,
yeah, just behave, yeah.
Well, when you join a big band, the Gerald Wilson Band and the Dizzy Gillespie Band, was there anything like an initiation period in which the other musicians in the band would test you out to see what kind of musician and what kind of woman you were?
Well, not with Gerald, because with Gerald's band, it was much of the same band that had been at the theater. So, and that was California, and I was known up there. But when I came to New York for to join the Dizzy Band, that was a bit of a trial. It's that same word, you know. Dog, you sent all the way to California for a female, geez, and things like that. But Dizzy had warned me that the guys might be a little irritable. So he said, not to worry, just practice. Keep your chops up and make a couple of 2-3 arrangements and bring them back with you. So when he called, he said, you ready? I said, yeah. Right. He said, well, your ticket's on the way. He said, did you write the music? I said, yes, sir. So he says, solid. So we make our first rehearsal, and I was greeted by, damn, you sent all the way to California for a dog and a rah, 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 thing. So he said, yeah, dog, did you bring the music? I said, yes, sir. He said, well, pass it out. And he said, anyone here that makes a mistake on the music is fired. Yeah, so we had a nice time. I had arrangement on Annie's Dance and Stella by Starlight, those two that I had written before I joined the Dizzy Band. So I passed them out, and when they heard the music, they said, oh, man, you know. And, you know, they just immediately turned around, and I became their sister, auntie, mama, daughter, whatever, and things like that. So it hasn't really been so bad for me because I was passed along from one to another. But for young girls that don't come up with that family type of thing, it is rather difficult. It really is. It's a sad thing to say, but that kind of prejudice, you know?
Well, let's hear a recording of Annie's Dance, one of the arrangements that you did when you first joined the Gillespie Band.
Okay.
Do you want to say a little bit about this arrangement and what you were thinking when
No,
when you
I
put
just
it together?
Wanted to be careful. When he told me to write something, I had nothing in mind, actually. So I said, well, I'll take something from the classics and kind of bebop it. That's a safety precaution there. And I always like Grieg, you know. So this is from a Nietzsche's dance. I love ballet and things like that. So I said, well, I'll do that. And, of course, being a female and things, at least they decided that I leaned toward the ballads and the sad songs and stuff of that nature. So I said, well, I'll take a ballet and a ballad, and that should keep things peaceful for me and my life with the guys. And it turned out that I ended up being the writer of the ballads in the band. There was Quincy who wrote more or less the sophisticated kind of music. Ernie Wilkins, who wrote the swinging blues and the hard rock jazz, and me that wrote the sad songs, the Billie Holiday type things and stuff like that. And so we developed a little family like that. But that was just some kind of guidance that you get from that little wee voice that speaks to you when you're afraid, you know, what to do. Say, write a ballad. And write something from classics, you know. Won't nobody be doing none of those things. So that's how I happened to write Annie's Dance. That's the name we called it afterwards. It was a Nietzsche's dance from Grieg's ballet.
Well, let's hear it. And this was recorded in 1956 with the Dizzy Gillespie Band, arranged by my guest Melba Liston, who's also featured on trombone.
Thank you.
Dizzy Gillespie Band, recorded in 1956, and Let Peace, Annie's Dance, was arranged by my guest Melba Liston, who was also featured on trombone. And Melba Liston will be leading her new big band in Philadelphia this Sunday at St. Michael's Lutheran Church at 6671 Germantown Avenue, with sets at 6 and 9 o'clock. And for more information, you can call the Wilbur Ware Institute at 438-3710. Well, before we heard that, you were telling us that this was one of the two arrangements that you did when you first joined Dizzy Gillespie's band. And the musicians were doubters. Here you were, a woman, or a female dog, as they were calling you, the slang name for that, coming to be with the band. And this,
all the way from California. This is the New York band.
I imagine they were pretty impressed when playing this.
Well, things changed. Really, they say, "Oh, Mama, you dig?" And she'd be all right and things. And they welcomed me into the family after that. But prior to that, they'd really been rude, you know.
Do you think that the men in that band or any of the other bands you played in ever changed their behavior around you? You know how in some, like, men's type things, they people say, "Don't say that. There's a woman in the room." Yeah.
No, I think they advised me that I'd have to get accustomed to their type of thing and just deal with it. No, I had to program myself to be one of the family and learn how to live with it. I couldn't expect them to change their lifestyle just because of the one girl in the band, me, you know. So I had to, you know, wash out my ears or whatever it was and learn how to go along with their way of life. And actually, it wasn't that different or that bad, really, because we were all about the same age group except for maybe one or two person. And we were all very naive and first time away from home and a lot of things. So they were just like most any other kids that I knew, except that they tried to pretend to be a little hipper because they were in New York and I was a stranger. I was a foreigner from all the way to California. But after a little time on the road and stuff, I found out they were just as naive as I was. And we ended up being very close, like family.
Did they feel, since they were men and you were a woman, that they should proposition you all the time and stuff like that?
No, they didn't bother me that way. After they accepted me, then they became overprotective. And I wasn't allowed to have any company. I had to get permission to go out of a hotel, and it was ridiculous. You know, it was over thing. Well, you know, you're just a girl and you're just, you know, out here new from California and we promised your mother and all of that business. And I really had a time getting out to see a friend or two here and there. I used to walk down the steps, not to ride the elevator, afraid I'm going to run into somebody, only to find that there was a guard standing down at the bottom of the steps. I'm like, "Where are you going? Back up to your room," and all of that thing. And if you're not accompanied by three members of the band and all that business. But it was good, I suppose.
Could you talk to them about that and tell them that you thought the security was a little too tight?
I tried. But at that time, it didn't matter. They just they said, "We promised your mom. And we're going to get you back to California in one piece. Nothing's going to happen to you while you're out with us, you know." But that was pleasant, I suppose. It was annoying. But, you know, even that part of it hasn't changed. So now they feel that I'm mom, and they still watch and see, you know, they don't like for me to be keeping company with anybody that hasn't passed their approval and all of that kind of thing. I have so many now. All the guys, I have children over 70 years old. All the musicians, My brothers are my children now. I am the mom. And so they're still protecting me.
In the 40s and 50s, when you were in some of the big bands, how were you expected to dress, and what kind of clothes did you wear when you were performing?
Well, in Gerald's band, in Dizzy's band, I wore suits and things to match the fellas, but I would wear a skirt rather than the pants, you know, to match the thing. But I would wear a shirt and a tie. I learned how to tie a Windsor and all of that. And then when, I don't know, somewhere along the way, it was, the weather was hot and all that, and I said, well, damn it, I want to put on a dress, you know? And I fixed my hair, and I put a flower or something in me somewhere along the way. I don't know when I did that. And I came out on the bandstand with my gown on, and everybody said, you know, I didn't know if I was going to get fired or what. And the guy said, oh, boy, I don't know, but, you know. But nothing happened. And then after a while, I was permitted to wear anything I wanted, which wasn't much because when you live out of a suitcase, you don't have but one black dress and a dark suit and some traveling slacks, so three or four white blouses. So it wasn't much choice, but then I started easing into long skirts and more feminine things like that, yeah.
Do you think life on the road was much different for a woman than a man?
Oh, yeah.
How?
The hygiene business. While you live on those buses for days and nights and things, it's difficult, you know. I mean, there's the time of the month, you know, and all of that. It's difficult. And then sometime when we're making deadlines and we're late and all that, the bus won't stop at gas stations and things because the guys will get out and waste too much time. So they just won't stop. And so the guys don't have to go to the, they can out the window. Yeah, you know. And so the girl is just in a problem.
I hear what you're saying. Yeah, it is a problem.
So I've had many twig and weeds and things for my toilet business, yeah, and things like that. That was really rather rough. Thank goodness there's not too much of that going on anymore. Well, the buses have the toilets, but we fly most of the time now anyway. But do you know, the road is still a road, and flying is, you know, you're just as tired, you're just as weary from today's road trips as you were way back then. But that was really rough.
Did you ever talk with other women musicians at that time about life on the road and playing with musicians?
No, not at the time. I didn't run into very many. It was only later when I moved to New York, and then Mary Lou Williams used to tell me about her experiences. I said, boy, I had it easy because during her career back there with the Annie Kirk days and all of that, it was even worse, you know. I couldn't even imagine how it could have been for her. But there really was no one for me to talk to about it, you know. The Sweethearts of Rhythm, I did meet them in the 40s. I was supposed to go with the band, but I selected to stay with the man's band at the Lincoln that I was with. But they had their own bus, and, you know, they traveled pretty nicely. Well, it was set up to take care of ladies.
I don't imagine this is something you really could have talked to with either the bus driver or the band.
You know, yes. And anyway, the girl was not to make a fuss, you know. I had to make sure that I remained, you know, I had to make sure that I caused no problem. I carried all my own luggage. I just, you know, I was not to make any waves if I was to survive in a man's world out there. So I learned that very early. So I managed somehow to take care of myself without complaining too much and things. But it was really, really hard. It was even hard much later when Patti Boone and I were together in Quincy's band in Europe there. We stayed over there 10 months, and we didn't really have boss agency and things. We were sort of freelancing over there. And we spent a lot of time in buses running all over Europe and things like that. And we had the same trouble again, but at least there was another sister on the bus, and I had extra voice where we were complaining. You got to let us stop. You got to let us stop. But we got to go get a room. We got to take a bath. We got to wash our clothes and things, you know. But the road is still hard. I'm sure it's perhaps just as hard for the guys, but, you know, some problems women have that men don't have. But the road is just difficult for anybody. Yes, sir.
Before we talk some more, let's listen to another one of the arrangements that you did. This is a very beautiful arrangement for a Betty Carter recording, Rodgers and Hammerstein,
yes.
Something Wonderful. Do you want to say a little bit about this arrangement? I think it's quite beautiful.
Well, I don't know. Betty and I are old friends. And at this time, I think I had my first apartment in New York. I'd been sharing, you know, or rooming with somebody and things like that when Betty got this date. And she came up to my little pad, and we spent 2-3 days together working out the routines and stuff. But, of course, she was more sophisticated than she was already accepted as a jazz star at that time and stuff. So I was really thrilled to be writing a thing. But I wanted to put a bit more passion and the tracks that I did for her than the guys did, you know. So I studied the lyrics and tried to do like a tone poem, tone parallel to the lyrics of the thing. And well, I was very happy with the results. I could have been happier had we had more time in the studio. But, like I was saying about things, the time, the studio, you know, we didn't have a lot of time allotted to us. She wasn't a big star at the time, neither was I, and things. And he says, well, we have to get out of here in 3 hours or something. So it was just a limited amount of time that we had to run the things over. So the musicians on the session had to just sight read it and then record it and go on to the next piece. We had maybe even a half an hour more, it would even have been more lovely, I expect. You know.
Well, let's hear this. This is, I believe, a 1958 recording of Something Wonderful, sung by Betty Carter and an arrangement by my guest, Melba Liston.
This is a man who thinks with his heart. His heart is not always wide. This is a man who stumbles and falls, yet this is a man who tries. This is a man you'll forgive and forgive and help and protect as long as you live. But now and then he'll say something wonderful.
Something Wonderful, Rodgers and Hammerstein tune that was written for The King and I, sung by Betty Carter, recorded in 1958, and arranged by my guest Melba Liston, a trombonist who will be leading her big band in Philadelphia this Sunday night at St. Michael's Lutheran Church on Germantown Avenue. And I'll have more information about that concert. You've been married three times. When you were...
Right, you did your research.
When you were married, would you leave performing temporarily for that? I know a lot of women have done that. They've left their professions during periods of marriage.
No, I didn't. I was, you might say, fortunate enough that all of my husbands loved the work that I was doing. As a matter of fact, if I tried to leave it, that's when we had our trouble. They loved me on stage. They didn't like me at home too tough. But anyway, no, my first marriage was my high school business, and the war took him away for almost 3 years, and so that was over when he got back. The next one was, well, that was a disaster. Mr. Woods, he got mixed up with some people that were involved in drugs and things like that, so that ended that. And my last one, I thought was for eternity and things like that. We didn't really have a problem. He was a teacher and things, and like I say, he loved my music and things like that. Still supports me, as a matter of fact. He, you know, whenever I perform in New York and the area of things, he comes and supports me and stuff like that. But I don't know. It's just, I don't know what it is about trying to be the female side of and working and keeping a house. It's just not easy. A man, I mean, all the guys, they need a woman to take care of them. You know, they can travel, they have somebody to do the laundry and pack the suitcase and cook for and carry on for them when they come home. But try to reverse it. It's just, I don't know. I don't know. Anyway, it hasn't worked so well for me. Although I'm happy to say that I'm still friendly with my exes and all that. You know, it wasn't that we had fights or problems of that nature. It's just that, you know, so much separation and, you know, sometimes I really would get tired and want to stay home and be wifely. And spouse would want me to go and take all these other jobs, you know. And I think my big trouble was them trying to push me too hard, you know, when I really wanted to stay home.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that's not too easy to explain, either to spouse or to even my own family, because everybody wanted me to keep going. Sometimes you get tired, you know, and things. And you know, and writing is a deep love of mine, and it requires solitude, you know, and peace and quiet, a lot of meditation time. And I suppose that's part of why I tend to keep going away by myself, you know. I don't know exactly the answers to all these things.
Have things changed much as far as working with men? Are there less stereotypes that you have to disprove when you're playing? First of all, people know who you are.
Yeah,
your
there's
reputation
no problem
is
for
proven.
Me. I wonder about the other girls. Janice Robinson's doing fine. And some of the girls are doing all right. But this last Women's Jazz Festival I did with Kobe, in June, listening to the girls, I think they're still having the same problem. I could tell that they hadn't had the experience that they needed. They hadn't been freely absorbed into the jazz thing because they were still stiff and a little shy and things. I don't think they're getting the proper input or outlet or whatever it is even now. I don't think so.
When you went to that first women's festival that you attended in 1979 in Kansas City, were there any surprises for you hooking up with this network of women who are interested in jazz and who played jazz?
Yeah, actually it was, because, you know, I'd been away three, four, I don't know how many years, but even prior to that, I just never had exposure to the females, you know. And I really was surprised to find out, look at that, she played. Well, look at that. I really was surprised at all the girls. They were really marvelous, really good musicians, good writers, good players, good singers. Now, I really was rather ashamed of myself. It wasn't that I had doubted any of them or something. I just had never paid any attention to that side of the business. I'd just been totally involved with the men. And I was rather ashamed of myself. And I hope that other people are ashamed, too, for not, you know, respecting the girls and things like that. But they're coming out of the colleges and out of the things well-learned. But they still need the experience. They still need the chance to get on out there and prove themselves. And that doesn't come easy, even right now.
Do you consider yourself a feminist at all, or is that irrelevant?
I don't deal with that.
Right.
They don't have a musical term for that. I don't deal with that. I don't know nothing about that. I want the best for everyone. I want fairness. If that's feminist, you know, but I want fairness. And if you can do it, I mean, give me a chance. You know, I'm for that. And the world has not been fair to us.
You've talked about a few things that you obviously really couldn't discuss with the band leaders at the time, you know, about being on the road and some of the obstacles that women faced and some of the differences traveling between men and women. Could you go back now to any of those people and talk with them about it now, or would it still be difficult?
Oh, yeah, I can talk to them about it now. Yes, oh, yes.
What kind of reactions do you get when you do that?
Oh, no, well, we're just like, we are really family now. Dizzy is like my brother or something, and Clark Terry's and all the other guys. We can sit and talk about everything. They can tell me how they looked at me in those days as a bone. You asked me about nickname. I did sort of have a nickname, was Bone, for trombone, you know. They'd say Bone, you know. He was about as corny, you know, and things like that. But we can talk about it now. We're all over 50, 60 and all that, you know, and things like that. But, you know, it's only because of their age. No, the same age group, you know, that I was with then, say the 30s and 40-year-old guys, they're not ready to hear about it. It's only the older people, mm-hmm. you know. But then they know about women, they know about life and everything, and they're more concerned, I suppose, or at least more patient anyhow.
You're leading your own big band now, and it's a 17-piece band. What's your band concept? Could you describe that for us? And how do you see the band you're leading now as related to the big bands that you came up with in the 40s and in the 50s?
Well, it's not much different. It's much in the same. It's much in the same parallel or something other like that. I love that era, you know. And so this is like a swing band. I have some tone colors and things perhaps that weren't common at that time. I've been a student of Duke's and listened to my classics and this and that and the other. So, and then with my years writing for Randy and all the African waltzes and jazz pieces that we've done together, I'm sort of a mixture of all that business, but... basically, my band is sort of like a 40, late 40s, you know, kind of like a disc. It's kind of bebop, you know.
Would there be any way of describing the steps that you go through when you're going to do an arrangement? Say you're arranging someone else's composition and they've showed you the composition, you take it home with you. What happens? What do you do with what's already written, and how do you arrive at your arrangement? I don't know if that's something that...
Well, it involves a lot. It involves the personality of the composer. If the composer is to be a performer, if it's to be recorded, then you have to deal with the composer, his style, his rhythms, and things like that. No, if it's the composer... It's only the composer, and it's like a lyrical thing, a vocal or something, other for someone else to do. You have to study that person, and you have to study the song and find out, I mean, what was really in their mind, in the back, for what you want to portray. I try to portray the same thing with my instrumental colors as they do with the lyrics or... the title or whatever you might say. So it's different. Almost each composition that I arrange is a different bunch of rituals that I go through, you know.
Can you hear it in your head as you're writing it out? Do you hear all the sections in your mind?
Not bang, 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 perhaps a section at a time or something. Sometime I get an overall feeling or overall view of the thing, and then I have to go in and then piece it together. But generally, that's what I try for. I try to find the rhythm, the mood, whether it's a gay, whether it's a festive, or whether it's a sad or a work type or sad or whatever. And then start dealing with it like that. Then it depends on your instrumentation and all of that. There's open writing where the horns are not spaced too close together for a kind of a joyous effect. And then there's for tension and tenses and stuff, there's the clusters and the very close writing and like the squeaky things, you know, that make you feel the pain and stuff. So you look for different effects, I guess.
Yeah. We'll be hearing another one of your arrangements in a minute, but before we have to close this interview, and I really wish we had a lot more time to talk. But
we have other time.
Yeah,
it's been
so.
A pleasure, too, to meet you.
Can you tell us about some of the people who will be in your band Sunday night that you're bringing to Philadelphia?
Oh, yeah, I certainly can. It's a marvelous band. Talking about a dream band. I have... Chris Woods, mighty fine alto saxophone, plays flute. Well, all of my reeds play their main saxophone plus flute plus sopranos and stuff like that. So I have Chris Woods on alto, Charlie Williams on alto, Harold Vick on tenor, and Billy Mitchell on tenor, and Cecil Payne on baritone sax. In my trumpet section, I have Raymond Reed, Eddie Preston, Alan Naylor, and Virgil Jones. These are all guys through my past. We've been together off and on. They've been with Ray Charles, they've been with Wade Basie, and everywhere. And my trombone section, my God, I got Slide Hampton, I got Janice Robinson, I got Benny Powell, and Jack Jeffers. Oh, my, you know? And in my rhythm section, I got on piano, Richard Wyans, and on bass, who I got? Oh, wait a minute. Who I got on bass? Oh, goodness gracious. I got Williams on drums. I can't find. Who's on? Larry Ridley. Yeah, I don't know how. I have to look on the paper. Larry Ridley is on bass for me. And Earl Williams on drums.
That sounds like a great band.
It's a great band, yeah. We haven't been in rehearsal yet. I'm going back to do that tomorrow. But knowing all of them and they know me and all of that,
right.
It should be really an exciting concert.
Well, I've enjoyed this last hour enormously.
Thank you.
I really want to thank you, Melba Liston, for speaking with us.
My pleasure.
We're going to hear another piece that you arranged, and this one was arranged for Randy Weston. It's a piece called Earth Birth.
Oh, let me tell you something about this, about arranging that you were asking me. To start off this, to make an introduction, I said, Earth Birth? How do you make an introduction to Earth Birth? So I remembered something about my Bible business, and so I said, let there be man, let there be woman, let there be love. So if you listen to the introduction, you'll hear the boom for the explosiveness of the work. And then the da 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 da, let there be. And dum 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 dum. And we're going into it. So that's how that happened. I remember that.
Great, okay.
Don't always, but that one.
So let's hear this 1958 recording of Earth Birth with Randy Weston at the piano, arranged by my guest Melba Liston, who's also featured on trombone. Thanks again for being with us.
Okay, thank you. Thank you.
Let There Be Light with, oh no, see, it sticks in your mind, Melba. That's Earth Birth, and Let There Be Light had to do with the story of how Melba Liston arranged that. It was recorded in 1958, Randy Weston at the piano. Melba Liston, who arranged it, was also featured on trombone. If you'd like to hear her big band, Melba Liston and Company, they will be featured this Sunday night at St. Michael's Lutheran Church at 6671 Germantown Avenue, with sets at 6 and 9 o'clock, and a concert sponsored by the Wilbur Ware Institute. And for more information, you can call them at 438-3710. Once again, that's 438-3710. It's 5 minutes after 3 o'clock, and this is Fresh Air. You're tuned to WUHY-FM in Philadelphia. In about an hour on Fresh Air, my guest will be Donald Drake, who is a reporter with the Philadelphia Inquirer. Last week, he had a series that ran throughout the week, starting on the front page of the Inquirer, on the homeless street people in Philadelphia, focusing mostly on the population of the homeless who have severe mental problems. So we'll be talking to him about what he found when doing the research for the series at 4 o'clock today. In about a half hour, we'll hear this week's edition of Jazz Revisited, and the subject today will be Swingin' the Classics. If you have trouble remembering, this program will probably be of special interest for you. It's on memory and forgetfulness. It was produced for the NPR Journal series by Linda Wagner.
This is NPR Journal from National Public Radio.
Thank you. And thank you for joining me for Remembrance, an exploration of memory in its myriad forms. We'll begin with a discussion of,
I forgot what I was going to say. How was I supposed to start? I can't remember.
It has been discovered recently that the biggest fear that Americans have, or people all over the world, is not death. This is very interesting. Death is number 6 in the list of 10. Number 1 is the fear of facing a group and speaking to them. The average reason for that fear is fear of forgetting and looking like a fool.
Fear of forgetting. That's what prompted this program, not to mention forgetting itself. Forgetting my keys, forgetting words. Why do I forget? How do we remember? When memory fails me, should I search my inner memory banks for the missing file, seek a new pathway to memory lane, or just shrug my shoulders and say, I was born with a faulty brain?
People complain about their bad memories because they are, I hate to prick balloons, but what they're doing is setting up good excuses.